of something like the Missouri River. It's an inch deep and a mile wide. Right? That's what happens in interdisciplinary scholarship. And you're always out of your depth, no matter what you're doing. And so it's a good chance I'll make a fool of myself and say something if you're a specialist. We don't have any theologians here tonight, do we?
Right.
In masters or PhDs. Vicki and I traveled up to Rochester for a conference of the Canadian and American Theological Association, which goes back and forth across the border here in eastern U.S. and Canada for meetings. And it was held at the seminary there at in Rochester, at the College and Seminary. And William P. Brown, who is an Old Testament theologian, was the speaker. And I have read his books, three or four of them, over the years, for my work in creation care and that theology. And he was the main speaker, and boy, that was a delight. The nice thing about the ASA is that you get to hear some of the very top people in the world, literally speaking. You get Francis Collins, and you can't get much better, right? And you get everything in between, and you get emerging scholars. You get these young people. So I've taken my students and had them put up posters, and I haven't had them give talks yet, but posters went up. And that's all professional and vocational development formation. That's a key thing in our mission and what we're trying to do. Tonight I'm going to try and get at this subject. So, first of all, if you were at the Wheaton meeting, did you hear my talk similar to this? Anybody in the room besides Randy? Okay. He wasn't listening. He was moderating. He was watching the clock. So he's going to listen tonight. But if he could watch the clock. This is like a classroom where they put the clock where the students can watch you go over time.
There's one over there.
Oh, thank you. There is one. And yeah, they're almost in sync. That was a little fast.
That's a good thing.
And so we're going to go at this a little bit. And this is a talk that I've been developing. It features elements of the paper that I wrote in Perspectives a few years ago. It's getting out of the subject that I think is vital for our day, critical to our thinking, but more important, critical to us in our practice, in our churches, in our leadership in those communities we're in. This is a critical conversation for our time, and it's one that's not being had very well. Although we'll see as we go through this, that I think theologians, the academic upper story theologians, the William P. Browns of Columbia, right? The Jürgen Moltmanns, the Wolfhart Tannenbergs in Europe, the Colin Guntons of the world. And if those names are not familiar to you, that's why it's stuck up there. And I've been reading those folks diligently since I retired 2 years ago, and for a long time, and it's hard. It's just difficult if you're not a theologian. And we need to bring that conversation down into the seminary theologians and then into the undergraduate level so that it works out into the pastors so they begin to preach these texts and these concepts and ideas. Because if you're, as I look around this crowd, most of us are, I'm a 1947, okay? And Bill's a sister? No. In Edmonton, your first cousin once removed in Edmonton is a 1939. Okay. Well, that's a different demographic than today. And I'll tell you that the social imaginary, the way we thought about ourselves that day, and the way we think about ourselves today is completely different. My grandfather saw the invention of the automobile. He saw the first aircraft. And as one of my prof's friends out at Simpson said one day, we were sitting at lunch, and he said, you know, I just came back from Washington, D.C. at the conference. And now I'm back in San Francisco. We flew over Kansas. You know, my grandfather broke the prairie in the 1880s in Kansas. And he said, you know, you tell my grandpa, one day, your grandson is going to be in a box 30,000 feet up there at about 620 miles an hour.
Right.
The world is a different place. The expectations are different, and the stories need to be different, too. And so let's see if we can see about those stories, and we'll is this going to work?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, and we'll see.
I'm going to treat this like I do the theology of evil class that I teach. I go in and lecture in, and I also go into the theology of creation class and lecture. And I've been doing that for several years. And this is the slide I start them with. So, what is that, and is it evil?
Sorry.
Okay. Hint, if you grew up on a farm, working or non-working, like I did, and about now shrinking from 30 years ago, about 25 or 30% of my students, down to about 10% of my students now, then you recognize it easy, and the hint gives it away. Oh yeah, that's a cow pie. But what are those yellow things on there? What are those little yellow things? Well, most of those are males, male dung flies. Here's one up close, and I mean, that's a face you gotta love.
Right?
And they are actively courting this cluster right here. It's probably a female in there. And they're actively courting and in competition for mating. And she will lay her eggs in that cow path. And the eggs will hatch. The larvae will consume that. So there's the question. Is that evil? Is there death there? We're not bothered about that. But why? There's death all over there. There is all kinds of dead material, plant material, cells that were consumed into the ruin of a cow. It spent a good long while. Oh, it came back up the throat and chewed for a cud, and then it went back down a while. It fermented, and on it grew all kinds of bacteria, protozoa. I teach invertebrate zoology. We have a cow. You can reach inside of it, take a sample of its stomach contents, put it in a thermos so it doesn't cool off, get it to the lab, put it on a slide, and there are protozoa. There are all kinds of organisms living in there. And when it comes out the backside of a cow and then it starts to, well, then things, lots of death present there. In fact, that cow path's not going to stay there. There are beetles that attack that and eat it, turn it into baby beetles. And if you don't have those, you end up like Australia. Here in North America, we have an entire suite of dung beetles, mm-hmm. dung feet. In Australia, brought cattle in, didn't bring the beetles. Within a matter of about a decade, every field was, if you've been on a farm, you watch behind a cow, it's walled, I mean, it doesn't take too many days to, right, to cover the carpet, just carpet the place. Think about Africa. You've seen all those pictures of the savannah, and the elephants are grazing. You know what comes out of an elephant? Mm-hmm. All right? I mean, it's like, but you pan the picture. Do you see those big mounds? No. Because immediately, those scarab beetles, the ones that the Egyptians worshipped, the dung, and they roll it away. And there's a huge competition, just a flurry of activity around that. Really fresh material, and off it goes. It gets recycled, and that produces soils. If you're in the north, it's ants. If you're in the tropics, it's termites and termite mounds. And we know this stuff, and we see it, but we don't think of the death that's there. That death is absolutely necessary to make what? Soil. So I'm an ecologist. But if ecology is a life science, why do ecologists spend most of their time studying death? Population ecology is all about regulatory factors. It's about disturbance. Those are synonyms for death. Disturbance means a flood came through. and turned up everything and killed most of the population. Or it means what happened in California. That's a real disturbance that Jack is having in Jack Swearingen, one of our members, Nancy, out in California right now. That's an ecological disturbance. Or the windstorm in the nor'easter that you just had that blew down all these trees and ripped material off and dropped it down and tipped over some trees, and they died. And we call that a disturbance. So death is all in there, and that's a part of succession of those systems. Our theory and practice revolve around this disturbance and stress and competition and predation and consumption, contest, and natural selection. Yet while ecologists deal exclusively with death, we rarely name it. Some years back, I was reading Ernst Becker's book, he's an anthropologist, 1973, The Denial of Death, it's his title. And in it, he details the exceptional denial in North America and around the world. We push death away and we don't talk about it. We formalize it, or we mock it as we're doing this week. We put it up and make fun of it. So do we professionally, do I actually deny death? I'm a Christian, but if Christianity is a religion of hope and new life, why do Christians spend most of their time talking about death? Hope and new life? But actually, well, there's Christmas, of course. It's about the newborn Savior. But Easter is centered on death. There's also the regular celebration of communion, that somewhat mysterious rite that's focused, certainly to outsiders, mysterious rite that's focused on brokenness and shed blood in a renewed covenant relationship. The eco-theologian Paul Santmeier reminds us that we Christians are unable to deny death. A religion, he notes, that has a crucified Messiah at its fulcrum hardly permits us to do that. Again, I was challenged. Do we believers practically deny the death we claim by faith? But in the rest of the world, we turn our back on it and we are offended by it. Here at the intersection of two major aspects of my life sits this discomforting question. Is death a necessity? Well, you'll see on that, that's a CSCA little pamphlet that has what I just read to you and a bit more. And you can download it off of the CSCA website. We probably have a link to it. Okay. Well, death is a powerful influence, and the social sciences have shown that, as have evolutionary biologists. It affects our judgment and our behavior. Look at this. This is my swimming pool. So I swim in the morning, and that's the poster on the wall. Mm-hmm. That gets your attention. Mm-hmm. My grandson, my child, you know, and it got my... I remember when I was a kid, grew up on a lake. I remember, that thing can kill me. It was just always... You were just always aware that's deadly. There's a hazard there, and I'm taking a risk as I approach that. But it's actually shaped us in some really interesting ways. If the awareness of death, the social scientists tell us, that shapes our attitude, it arouses us to action. And it's not always positive. It changes our judgments about things. You do controlled experiments, and they've done, the social scientists, over the last 30 years, have done 500, 600, 700 empirical studies on death awareness, and it changes your attitude. Just talking to you tonight about death, it made you more conservative in your judgments. You're more likely to be harsh on people who violate our social standards. They gave two cases to judges. Judge A, and you have to make assess a fine. Judge B, you have to assess a fine. You read an essay that talks about your death, personally. You read an essay that talks about something in general. Turns out the one who read about death is more harsh in the sentence that they give or the fine that they assess. You go, wow, that's just peculiar. No, I'm making a judgment. No, just thinking about your mortality, just having it pushed in your face is enough to change our mind. We can do all kinds of things with that. Next one.
So the history of Christian thinking on death is really interesting. If we go back to the medieval church fathers and think with them, we see that the church had what was called Ars Vivendi. In the Middle Ages, especially the late Middle Ages, you have famine and Black Death that dominates, 13th, 14th century. And you, especially in the Black Death, a third of the population in Europe dies. And coming out of that is you lose your professional class of priests. But the professional class of priests are doing something more than just the mass on Sunday morning. They and the nuns are running the hospitals. Hospitals, 300-400 years before, were invented by the church to be of service to the culture. Because the early church were known in Rome and throughout the empire for picking up babies that were being left out to die, for going and healing the sick during famine and during outbreaks of disease. And that's what they were known about. And they started the institutions of hospitals. So this changes over time from Francis Assisi here, as N.T. Wright says, about exploring the options. There's been, in fact, an oscillation between two poles, which you can see by walking around any old church and looking at the at its monuments. Some of the monuments envision death as a horrid enemy stalking its prey. The other pole of belief is represented by Francis Assisi's hymn, All Creatures of Our God and King. Right? All creatures of our God and King. And it turns out there's this remarkable invocation of, and thou most dear and kindly death, waiting to hush our latest breath. And Francis lies down and welcomes Sister Death. Right? So you have these poles, even within the church as a whole, and certainly in the Latin church, but I would suggest right through history. And as Christian thought has oscillated between seeing death as a vile enemy and as a welcome friend. Now, N.T. Wright goes on to talk about traditionally, and we're going to do that too. But first, a little aside. Death and suffering has been with us for a while. This is the classic one. You may not recognize this, but that's a caterpillar, a pupa, right? A little butterfly, really interesting. And on it is one of the parasitic wasps, not the yellow jacket kind of wasp. These are the parasitic ones. And it's stinging, laying its eggs in here to consume them. This was a problem for Charles Darwin, because the caterpillar, the larva that hatches out from that egg will consume the inside of that caterpillar, but it won't destroy its nervous system. It will eat the musculature, but it doesn't destroy it. It keeps it alive. It literally eats it alive. And if you want to know all about this, it's influenced all kinds of Hollywood stuff. One of the best ones is Sigourney Weaver in Alien from back in the 70s. You know, a little Hollywood in that. But in fact, this is throughout the creation, everywhere. And so it's a problem. This is an aphid. We don't like aphids, and that one's been hollowed out by a little single parasitoid that was in it. So it's really common. Go to the next one. The Darwinian method has really informed our thinking, and it's troubled us in the church. It's a powerful method of looking at the world and seeing this natural selection that's going on. And that's a synonym for death and dying out there. Natural selection is that basic mechanism of evolutionary theory. It's a synonym for death. So let me tell you how many ways you can die if you're an animal organism. This is Kolbe's text in 1973. You can starve. We think of death in the chase, right? And sure, here's predation. There's predation. And it's marvelous, these sockeye salmon. Parasitic disease, accident, failure to find a mate. Genetically, if you don't mate, guess what? Your genes are dead.
They're gone.
That's a form of death. And failure to be born. All those embryos down there inside of a white-tailed deer. We've been looking at white-tailed deer this weekend. And over the weekend, we saw them all. And they're little fawns, right? They get twos and threes that are coming out. And you go, wow. But they get hit on the road all the time. Pregnant does. Bam, bam, bam. Well, the fetuses die as well. So there's death everywhere. But we still drive the roads for you to, for our own good reasons. So that is a regulatory mechanism. I often stop here and say to my students, now let's see, whose idea was that? Let's see. That was Darwin's idea to make all those animals die. Oh no, it wasn't Darwin's idea. He's just describing it. But it is somebody's fault. It has to be. You saw that big salmon that was turning red there. That's an interesting story. They fight their way up after 4 years out in the ocean, 3 or 4 out in the ocean. They fight their way up, and inside of a few weeks, they go from healthy green to that bright red. Then they get a kind of cottage cheese-like rot down their sides. And they literally fall apart as they're battling to mate in the street, and they die. The eggs are laid. The bodies flow down into the boneyard in the lakes in sockeye salmon, and they build up in mounds as big as this room and twice as deep of bodies. The phosphorus and nitrogen, but mostly the vital phosphorus, especially on the West Coast where it all gets washed out to the sea by the rain, that vital phosphorus, it happens here with Atlantic salmon and your shad and anyway, the rest of the species that migrate up and down your rivers here. It's a common phenomenon, and those bodies become the parents become the fertilizer that grows the phytoplankton and the zooplankton to feed the what? The babies hatch, and the little fry, and mommy and daddy set the table. And it's that great cycle of life. Well, why do they die like that? It's like a switch has been thrown. In fact, it has. It's called programmed cell death. And it's essential to us. We discovered this a long way. We knew a lot about it. In the 1970s, working with this worm, Cena rhabdus, a little white worm, graduate students, you can put them in the room and have them count cells late into the night as these things grow. They don't know any better. They're highly motivated. One night, a graduate student was watching these cells grow. That cell died. It was there, and it died. It right in front of me, under the scope. He and his professor got the Nobel Prize for that work. It's pretty nice work. It turns out that there are 1,260 cells or something like that in the animal, and then about 40 or 50 of those cells or a little more die. And it shrinks back to the adult size. Programmed cell death, and there you see it, the arrows point to the little round cells inside of the embryo that are in the process of apoptosis. And there are 25 or 30 varieties of apoptosis, and it's critical in understanding cancer. And that's where the medical community has taken this aspect of biochemistry and developmental biology and explained it in enormous detail, but it doesn't get out of the research into your thinking that these cells die on program. It's vital for everything about us, for the formation of limbs, for the formation of digits, sculpting the outside as a cross section of a plant, the sculpture of the texture of the outside of the plant. Here you see a little lace plant, and you see these, that had cells in it. Those openings that create that structure. The leaves. The tail that gets resorbed. We say it gets resorbed. Okay. And that's the same resorption you have if you injure yourself. Programmed cell death. Wound healing. Adjusting the number of cells in an organism. And then eliminating dangerous and damaged tissue, wound healing.
So you see development, and sometimes it goes wrong. This is syntactically. But you go from this to this. So why don't we have webbed hands? Why don't? It's because developmentally, program's still dead. So death can't be just a pure evil. Can't be. This is a genetically conserved, what you say, program. It's shared phylogenetically with other organisms. In fact, we know it's present right down different genes, but it's present throughout the bacterial community and kingdoms. So it's there in the archaea, it's there in the true bacteria, all life forms. Well, now we get close to the things that I like. This is ecology, and stuff that we learned and start in junior high school, when you learn kind of the food web and what eats what and the arrows that go there. And Robert Payne, working in rocky intertidal, not unlike the rocky intertidal here, but this was out in the Puget Sound, Pacific Northwest, he was doing this work, and he discovered what's called the keystone species concept. So these are giant sea stars, Piaster. His graduate students collect them out of all those rocks, right, at low tide. They would collect them all and use them like frisbees and throw them back out into the ocean and remove them from the community. And it's like doing what? It's like taking this guy out of the picture. So what happens to white-tailed deer when you take cougars out of eastern North America? You put a lot of them in the back.
Yeah, right.
Right? White-tailed deer explode. And there's a complex, this is way simplified to what food webs are like. There's this complex set of interactions that's mediated by death, by consumption. There's also different talk, non-consumptive effects of predation. Just being in the presence of a predator changes your behavior as an organism. That's the talk I gave at Gordon 2 years ago. And we'll come back to that next year at San Diego. If you want to hear that one, I've got a theologian and my ecology student coming, and we're going to bring about 4, 5, 6 other people to talk about the fear and dying. But here's how it works at the planetary level. That's a single-celled alga. That happened to be Clunomonas reinhardi, which is freshwater, but it's similar to these marine species. This is the south coast of England. Looking from space, you see a bloom of algae. In the ocean, you can see it from space, all single cells. We knew in the 1930s and 40s that that collapses. Those algal blooms in the North Sea and across the North Atlantic, they form, and then in a matter of 2, 3, 4 days, they collapse. It's like somebody hit a switch, but nobody had any idea what that switch was. Program, cell, death. This is the switch that gets thrown across hundreds of square kilometers at a time. Those organisms influence the atmospheric gases and help to balance the carbon balance in the atmosphere, which influences the heat balance of the Earth, which makes it possible for us to live here. And that's all dependent on death. So, push the drama farther and get it closer to us. Planetary level, now we're back to the beginning of the Enlightenment and the Age of Discovery. And here you have Francis Bacon. At that front end, he writes a book on the history of life and death. I found this and I went, yes! Bacon was thinking about this. And he was urging his colleagues to help the common good, that through it, the higher physicians will somewhat raise their thoughts, that they will become the instruments and dispensers of God's power and mercy in prolonging and renewing the life. This is life extension. He's wanting them to get going on solving the real problems of the day with this new scientific method, this empirical method that he had come up with, cutting-edge science of the day. What happens with it? Well, you come forward to 1900, what happens here, age across there, 50 years here, 60, 80, 90s, what happens? Well, here is high infant mortality, and that you can go from 1900 all the way back. High infant mortality. And high infant mortality, and then what? There's the demographic. Most people checking out here by the time they're 70, a few making the 80, and a slow decline. By 2016, what's happened? We've shifted the mortality. We've reduced infant mortality, and we've what? Extended the mass of people that are living into old age. I'm a baby boomer. Many of you in the room are. We blew the doors out of every institution we came in. Just by our being there. Our schools got big. Our grade school had to get big. They were always bringing new chairs in. Or these new portable buildings or something. So what has happened now is this death spike is getting steeper and steeper. It's pushing out. And so now what we're doing is we're working on all these technologies to keep us healthy and vigorous and active before we fall off the steep end of that curve. And people are out here saying, wow, is 100 and 120 the maximum? What about life extension? Could we extend life beyond? That's a cool word map, right, of the notion of life extension. Why is this life extension discussion possible? It's because of what's called the medicalization of death, beginning in the end of the 19th century. In the end, if you were around then, you were dying at home. Only 2-3% were dying in hospitals. By 1920, 25% were dying in hospitals, communicable disease. And then the Asian flu epidemic breaks out. It was a pandemic around the world. In the 1930s, we get antibiotics discovered, and we often say that's what drives the population curve up. Actually, it's no. It's the infant mortality, it's soap, and it's good food, and it's cleaning up our water supply so that our waste treatment goes downstream and our drinking water comes from upstream. Good idea to get your drinking water upstream from where you dispose of your wastewater. Okay. We got that all figured out, and we took off. That meant we were on this escalator that Bacon could only imagine of effective technological medicine, and has changed our view of ourselves. So what about using stem cell therapy? You've heard of this. You know these guys. Both of them have been recently in the news and talking in their programs on TV about their stem cell treatments. And today we talked to, this morning, this is fresh off of this morning. James Shirley. It's late in the night. James had breakfast with us. He's got a startup company, biotech company, that he's been working on in Boston. And he does stem cell therapy work, working with the youngest. That he's been working with some of the youngest. That is the pre- and postnatal infants. But he's also developed a technique for measuring the number of stem cells in a treatment. And he told us this morning that about 20%, about one-fifth, one in five people that get a stem cell treatment in an experimental test, it fails. We don't know why. And then he said this, Randy, we don't count the number of stem cells. We just generate the stem cells, assume that they're there, and inject them. We've had no method for actually counting how many are there. So you don't know if you're giving them the drug or you're not giving them the drug. You don't know. No wonder we're having problems. James is working at that. It's stunning work. He's one of our newest members in the ASA. Okay? But what's happened just recently is an explosion of venture capital. In the last 4 years since I started this project, literally billions of dollars have been raised for life extension. This is moving it past 100, 120, And there's all kinds of speculation going on. And is there a limit? Isn't there a limit? And guess what? All kinds of people are pouring money into this, and it's the richest people around the world. And it's venture capital. It's Craig Venter from Celera, the Human Genome Project with Francis Collins, right? And a host of it's Google. It's a host of the biggest hitters economically in the world, and the computing power and artificial intelligence and all that capacity being directed at immortality. Let me think. We focused on Genesis 3 as the fall and the source of sin and death. And then we forget that there was an angel put up in front of the garden so that we wouldn't go in and grab what? The fruit of the
tree.
Oh, I don't need to go into the garden. I've got the digital computer. I've got cloud computing. I have billions of dollars to throw at life extension. I don't need your garden and your tree. I got my own tree. This is a fascinating discussion, and I don't think we're having it in our around. Well, whose hands are those? This is an off the cover magazine of McLean's magazine in 1990. So whose hands are those? Well, they're our hands. This is the run-up to the Rio Convention on the United Nations Convention on Biodiversity in Rio, where we first began to hear about climate change and its problems and the loss of species diversity and all that. But if you're my age, he's got the whole world in his hands. He's got the whole... No, he doesn't. I got the world. We have the world. That's a change in social imaginary. We have changed our minds about practically, pragmatically, economically, education, government, a huge move. This has all been happening, and philosophers are describing it for us, and they're practically, we're all secular now. So here we go. We've had a view of death, and we followed Augustine in that view and early church fathers. Augustine was debating something other than what we are. He had a different problem on his hands. And I know that because I've read the scholars on it. There's a whole bunch of young, bright young scholars putting out stuff on the early church fathers right now. And it's fascinating work. And they had their debates. They're not our debates. And in that debate, Augustine had a view. He tended to see death as a result of the fall. But actually, he changes his mind a couple of times in there. That's why you know he wasn't thinking about the way we think about it. So as you read Augustine, apparently, across time, which I haven't done, he depending on what issue he's dealing with. But this is standard, and I usually, in my class, I'll give out copies of standard handbooks, Bible handbooks, off the library shelf from 1970s, and it will say what Davies says right here. This is a traditional view of death. Normally, I would stop right here and have you talk about this for a while. Tonight, we're going to keep moving. Okay, and that is that death originates in the garden, and death permeates the world. And carnivores get sharp teeth because they were eating grass. And that's been our social imaginary that's really influenced our church and our conversation and influences our politics. You hear it coming out of people in Congress. Well, consider this. In the early 20th century, Ludwig Kohler said, none of the Old Testament books referred to back to the story of Adam and Eve to explain sin and evil. It turns out, and here we have a Western Orthodox, not Eastern Orthodox view. Eastern Orthodox view, the Roman Church said sin results from Adam and Eve in the fall. So sin, then death. The Orthodox invert that. We are dying physically, and out of that motivation, we sin. It's a different theological framing. We need to explore that. and rethink that. So here's some of the people: Karl Barth, Dietrich Bonhoeffer, Emil Brunner, all of the 1930s, talking about finitude and endings. Bernard Graham, in our own fellowship, he only talks a little bit. In geology, he really talks about extinction. And he's saying it isn't a problem. He's a Baptist in background. Warren Wilkinson from Regent, James Barr in the Gifford Lectures in 1992, major statement on finitude. That is, creatures are mortal. They were made mortal. Never, it didn't come, it came with creatureliness. Here is, we've turned the corner. We've gone out of those upper story academics, and now it's down to people that you'll recognize. Catherine Sonderegger, you may not recognize, I'm going to give a quote from her. John Walton, you probably will, from the Lost World of Genesis 1 and his other Lost Worlds from Wheaton, and a host of other people. These are all folks in evangelical seminaries and around. And here's Sonderegger. She ties this not to the kinds of things you normally hear, she ties it to the providence of God, providential provisioning. And she says, starting from the conviction that the cosmos and its creatures are ordered by mortality and death, all creatures in the cosmos as a whole are marked out, they're ranked, they're structured by natural death. Death is not principally and properly the last enemy, rather it is the structure and order of creaturely being. And that's not Charles Darwin's idea. That's God's idea. It's the way he made it. And so we need to have a conversation. We need to rethink how we've thought about death and dying. And here's Walton. And it's more complex than this. But all of this, all this ecology I just explained to you, all of this indicates that clearly that death did exist in the pre-fall world. And he goes on. Here we have Douglas Moo, father, Jonathan Moo, his son, both products of Wheaton, both theologians, one at Whitworth, one at Wheaton. This is their ecological creation care text. The curse does not seem to represent some sort of mysterious ontological change in the very makeup of creation. Yeah, your undergrad students go, what's he talking about? Well, the story does not imply that human beings were created immortal. That stuff you learned in Sunday school, when I had this conversation with Kathy the first time, and then one of her friends in my home, this is, we were like, she was like, you tell me what? This is a shock to your system. But I want to move to creation care, because this is a piece that's gone missing completely. And I want to talk about the theory of creation care, how we care for the earth. Been worked out of the Asabal Institute and a bunch of other things. So what does a positive view, this view that I've been invoking here, what does it do for us? Well, first of all, the first principle is that biotic death is present from the beginning. It's in the Genesis story. You read Genesis 1, and there's what? There's fruitfulness there. Be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth. And if you're a great white shark, how do you do that? If you're a cougar, how do you do that? If you're a pelican, if you're a robin, the birds of the air, the fish of the sea, all the swims, paths of the sea, let life, life, life. And how do you life, life? You eat things. Death. They are twins, and their death was present, and we've been reading right past it. The second principle is land. The land, this is Walter Brueggemann. The land is a gift of, no, it's not Walter Brueggemann. I'm sorry, this is Moses. This is Deuteronomy. Deuteronomy is my favorite book. You gotta read Deuteronomy. Moses is talking about this stuff. Care for the widow. Care for the orphan. Care for the alien. Don't lock them up, take their children away, and throw away the key. Sorry, I'm being really political. Okay? It's hard to be an American, and now we are Canadian citizens, but it's hard to have grown up in this land and stand on the other side. I'm an alien. I'm an alien in this country in some ways, but I'm a citizen here. I'm an immigrant there. And you just read Deuteronomy and you say, wait a minute, time out here. Let's get some, I don't want an adult in the room. I want a prophet, I want a preacher in the room. I want somebody that will preach the word to me in the gospel. And we don't have it. And it's a gift. And it's been given because he puts the land in there as well. The land is in that list multiple times in Deuteronomy. And we don't see it. And there's what? There's a vineyard. There's and trees. And there's geologic processes. And there's millions of years of death and dying in order to generate the soil, to grow the things that we eat and we enjoyed at our meal tonight. And that's the creation care message, that the land participates with us. And in Colossians, Jesus is in what? God in Christ is redeeming what? Oh, he's redeeming us. No, the entire what? Tapanta. The entire cosmos. Tapanta. All of it. And it says it in Hebrews. It's all being redeemed by God. The work of Christ on the cross. And the pruning metaphor. When Jesus talks of these agricultural metaphors, we think, oh, man, that was nice. That was cute. Oh, we don't farm anymore. No. He was getting out a central. Now, think about what Jesus did in his life as well. But pruning and death are essential to life. And there's something good about that. Now, don't get me wrong. Death is not to be celebrated. Death is the last enemy. And it's defeated. But when we say death and death, oh, death and death. No, there's death and death. You saw Princess Bride? That was late 1980s, okay? And they got the guy's dead. He's been had all life sucked out. Well, there's dead and there's mostly dead. He's just mostly dead. With all dead, nothing you can do. Just go through their pockets and look for loose chains. Billy Crystal, terrible. That's a wonderful movie. Okay, back to this pruning metaphor. Now we're going to go forward. I think it's something interesting. We've had two autistic persons that have come into our public consciousness to change our social imaginary, our minds, to try and influence us. Most recently, down here, Greta Thunberg, she shot through New York and hit the United Nations building and said, you can't do that to my generation. You're just sitting there and you're killing us. And she got up to Canada and did the same thing. She's a remarkable girl if you don't know her story. She is a prophet in our day. But you may have missed in 2010, the movie, this is when it hit me. I didn't know the work of Temple Grandin other than her behavioral work on cattle. I knew a few things, but it was the movie that really gave it to me. There's this wonderful scene because she's working with cattle and they're in the yard and the cattle are going up the ramp to be slaughtered. And the cow goes up the ramp and they hit it with the bolt in the head to kill it, and then the chain gets hooked onto it, and the carcass is lifted up, and she said, where'd it go? And she's with a bunch of guys, right? And it's a woman in a men's world. And the guy's 28. She said, where'd it go? He says, what go? She said, it was a cow, and now it's meat. Where'd it go? That's a question. We destroy God's creation and we don't even give it a thought. It's disposable. We put it in our bins and we don't give it a thought. We have to start thinking about these things. Because here, we need to rethink Jesus' passion and his text. Therefore, since we are surrounded by such a great cloud of witnesses, let us throw off everything that hinders and the sin that so easily entangles. This is Hebrews 12. And let us run with perseverance the race marked out before us, fixing our eyes on Jesus, the pioneer and perfecter of our faith, for the joy that was set before him, he endured the cross. He set his face to Jerusalem, and he told his disciples, get behind me. I'm going to go do this. I am going to die. It's intentional. That's why I came. That's what I'm here for. It's not a mistake. And I will be tempted by Satan, and I was. And I was tempted to do what? I was tempted to ignore God's calling and die on the cross. To die. I was tempted that, and I was tempted to take what? Political power, economic power, social power. That was the temptation. I was tempted to live forever. We need to rethink death and dying, a new ars vivendi for our day. I think we're at a stage, at a moment in the history of the earth where the entire planet is threatened. We have the opportunity to rethink that and marshal the gospel and the resources of scripture and history of the church and bring it forward. Begin to understand what they understood in the 14th century. There, the social imaginary was expressed as these icons. This is a chapel. And here you have Christ harrowing in hell. He harrows hell. And it's a wonderful thing. It's an agricultural metaphor. He goes to hell, and he does what? Adam and Eve, the first fruits of all the dead, the disciples, for the resurrection. Well, we tell these stories, and we tell the story of the passion of Christ. My God, why have you forsaken me? And what is the answer that Jesus gets? Dorothy and I understand this.
I'm waiting for somebody else.
What is the answer that Job gets? I put my hand over my mouth. I spoke about stuff I didn't know what I was talking about. And for three long chapters, the longest single discourse of God in Scripture, God goes on to talk about the details of the philosophy of death and resurrection. No, he goes on to talk about what?
Creation.
Absolutely. And we ignore it. My students can't even name the animals around. They can name more things in Africa than they can name in their own hometown. They don't see it. They can't even identify cowshed, as we say up in Canada. You wouldn't know it if you had it on your boots. And you wouldn't know where it came from. You don't know to stand away from the back of a cow when it raises its tail. Because something's coming out. And it's going to be wet or gooey. And you don't want to be near because plop, plop. They don't know that stuff. And we don't teach that stuff. Here's the last, and then I'm going to draw this to a close. I want you to, we can die well. We can die like the saints die. We can die like the patriarchs die. Judy Cantillon, this is her son. Her husband, Kevin, was a student of mine. This is a picture that he took. This is Connor's artwork of John Bonham, Judy's dad. That's him as a young man. And Connor is edited on that box. And they're sitting in this room, John's sitting there. And it's the Reverend John Bonham. He's been 45 years or more, Baptist preacher in Edmonton. And this is an email he sent to Judy, his daughter. Judy, I now have two reservations for my next two residences. This is in September last year. Today I was confirmed that there's a hospice room now reserved for me at the General Hospital on the ninth floor. Ruth went and she inspected it, led by the hospital chaplain, David Peterson, who's a member of one of the churches, a church I actually helped to start back in the 1970s. Part of my heritage, that hospital chaplain. He gave her a tour and she was pleased with the facility, but not with the parking. She had to get a good direct bus service from our condo to the front door of the hospital. So, my last reservation, the second one, my last reservation was made for me by our Savior, electing God in eternity past, purchased for me by our Savior on his cross, and confirmed to me by the gift of the Holy Spirit at the moment of my conversion, reconfirmed thousands and thousands of times in the years of my adulthood. It is a glorious, eternal, powerful, musical, alive, beyond our imagination, fulfilling all our intellectual and emotional and psychological and social and spiritual capacity. This is to his daughter. The journey goes on for how long? ... Reverend John Baum. He died in December. December 22nd. A few months after we wrote that. What's he doing? What's he doing there? What's he doing in this letter? What's he doing? Oh,
sorry.
What's he doing there?
Close the box.
Who's going in the box?
He is.
That's his mortuary box. Built and etched by his grandson. But I need to get a financial legacy to leave for my children. I can leave them millions. If you don't have a million in your estate, I mean, how are you going to get to retirement and get through it and leave something for your kids? And we have a message, but we need to rethink our view of life and of death and to tell that message. That's it. Thank you. There are some resources on the next slide. That pamphlet is on that website, and I did that article back in 2016. That's the ecology stuff. Eventually, I'll write this up, but it preaches better than it reads. And you probably have questions. I knew I was preaching to the choir here, but you guys are experienced and have been through so much of this. So I took a bit liberty. I don't quite do this with my students. They're coming from a broader distribution and less experience, so. But you might have questions.
Yeah. I guess one of the indications of what you're talking about in terms of our understanding of death is the transition that we've gone through in our culture from funerals or death being held, the dead person being taken care of in the home parlor.
Yes.
Right? Now it moves to a funeral home, and we change the name of the parlor to the living room.
The living room, yes. Yeah, and we talked about Uncle Roy, and he's out at the golf course, and he's in heaven playing golf.
Oh, yeah, no.
He did.
Yeah.
He did. Robert Jensen, Lutheran theologian, died a couple of years. Robert Jensen, he liked George Murphy. He's a Lutheran. He gets this stuff. And Jensen says, the one thing I can't imagine is my own death. I can't even think it. Because every time I think it, I think I'm here. Or I see a dead body, and I see me. No. When you're dead, you're dead.
Yeah.
You're undone. You're unbeing. It's like, where was I when I wasn't here? Oh, I was on a rack somewhere, and Jesus pulled me off and stuck me in a body.
You were disembodied.
You were disembodied. Yeah. I mean, Paul says it. It's a mystery. We have really trivialized death, and we've made it tame. We call it tame death. And our culture is transcendental. Charles Taylor says, we live in a world where it's possible to have exclusive humanism. It isn't a matter of, is there a God? There isn't. It isn't even a category. My fellow graduate students of Berkeley, they were heathens. And they had no idea. God wasn't always, there's a memory. They kind of miss him. But they don't believe in it. And so he talks about a cross-pressured world. You get the new religionists like Garrison Keillor.
Yeah.
Keillor doesn't believe, but he believes. He believes in the memory. And you hear it all the time invoked in his stories, and he invokes that emotional memory. But he doesn't believe. I know he doesn't, because I've read enough of his stuff. Stephen Hawking invokes God continuously before he died. But yes, you get to it in the end, and you realize, no, his God is a mechanism that drives the universe. At most, it has nothing to do. And this thing goes back, Randy's read the journal enough
and Ed had been around to know that Mark Knoll touched on this back in 2012 on the 15 big ideas of history, and this is about univocity of being, a big debate between that comes up right at the beginning of the Enlightenment with Duns Scotus and Aquinas. And it's univocity of being, that is the character of God. Is God another being like us, just more powerful, or is he utterly transcendent and different and unapproachable? And we went two ways. And the Enlightenment basically took the Duns Scotus route, and what you get now is humans made in the image of machines. The interchangeable parts, we're growing them, we're making them, we're doing them. The implications of this are enormous. I think death, this view of death, is the lens that we need to start shining. So instead of talking about individual problems, we put this whole suite in a basket and say, oh, wow. Because the Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, and Deuteronomy stories, but in particular Genesis and Deuteronomy, these great polemics against the death cults of their day, against the heathen mechanistic ideas that came from the Assyrian area and from the Egyptians, were pressing on. They said, no, it's not about science. I mean, it's not about science. They don't really care about words. And the first one's a 500-word essay on how the world gets here. Mm-hmm. They weren't looking for detail. It was a polemic. It was a new social imagination. No! Imagine Yahweh, not these little gods you're talking about. And today, our people are talking about all kinds of things. They're talking about stem cells. They're talking about all kinds of life extensions. Thank you.
So, John, you gave a very powerful and compelling argument here that we need to rethink death, but you didn't give us a whole lot of guidance in terms of how to rethink it, what the answers are, so you left us. So,
yes.
Can I ask you about a possibility? Yeah. Because I'm sitting here thinking about, we typically think of death in either a physical sense or a spiritual sense.
Yes.
Now, you made a very dramatic argument here that physical death is a necessity in this world, and we're a part of this world. You said very little about spiritual death. But as Christians, we're familiar with the concept. But it seems to me, if we look at the Bible and wherever it refers to death, that trying to ascribe either a purely physical interpretation or a purely spiritual one just doesn't cut it.
Nope.
You know, wherever, if you try to say, is this physical or is it spiritual?
Right.
Neither one really answers. So what occurred to me here, something I've been thinking about for a while, but you're kind of sharpening it here, I wanted to know what you thought about it, is I wonder if instead of that, there isn't a view of death that in an interesting way is common to evolution and Christianity, which is the basic principle of life from death, that death isn't all physical or all spiritual, but in both senses, there is the fundamental principle that death leads to life. So when we talk about shall never die, doesn't necessarily mean that the physical organism stays forever. But there's a deeper truth, as C.S. Lewis would say, deeper truth that life comes from death.
Yes.
And that's inherent in both evolution and Christianity.
Lest a seed fall into the ground and be genetically engineered.
Right.
Oh no, fall into the ground and die. Mm-hmm. It abides alone.
Yeah.
Death, you start reading, and I don't know when I've been reading the gospel this way for a long time. I just didn't know it until a few years ago. I've always seen this stuff in what Jesus was talking about. He talks about this all the time. He's constantly talking to the disciples and trying to get them to figure out, I'm really going to die. This is really going to happen. And it's intentional. And I'm doing that to do the spiritual work that has to get done. And I'm doing it at the same time. He said, well, which is it? Is it spiritual or physical? And he says, yes. He's wonderfully Hebrew, because the Hebrew approach is, here's the problem. I'm looking at it this way.
Wow, that's interesting.
You know, I mean, Moses walks all around the problem and talks about it. And the Greeks, give me this, 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 and this.
I needed the critical path to the answer and the right answer. So I'm back with my students in class, or what's the right answer? I'm like, yes. Often the right answer is the question. So you're right. I deliberately, because my view of what the church does here is we've got the answer. It's called four spiritual laws. We have the answer. It's just nobody's asking that question anymore, unfortunately.
Well, you know, I'm on board because I'm an ecologist too, and I have to explain that death is not a bad thing necessarily. But midway through the talk, you suddenly said, well, I don't really like death.
Yeah.
And it was like okay for salmon and okay to eat, an insect.
Yeah.
But when we talk about, I'm very sensitive to constantly having to say, it's not like I want people to get cancer. Right? And I think I've been thinking about what the barriers are, and I just want to list a couple and see what you think.
Thanks.
But one is, the minute you start talking specifics about the things that cause death for people other than people that die at a very old age.
Yes.
None of them are pleasant.
No.
So that's one problem. But hold on.
Okay. Thank you.
A second one, though, is the Bible often tells us to pray.
Yeah.
It says we could pray and a mountain will move.
Right.
So if God's providence, it seems almost magical. That is, it doesn't seem to follow the laws of nature. God's going to open the heavens and pour this out.
We can pray
and these things will happen that wouldn't happen under natural laws. So how do we jive God's providence?
Right.
Okay. Don't go yet.
That's two.
Two.
She knows you.
This is one that came up with my students this last couple of weeks. And they said, in the Bible, it describes heaven. And the lion is down with the ox, and the wolf is with the lamb. There's no predation. There's no darkness. There's no tears. How is it possible that this could all be good and could be God's plan if that's what heaven is going to be?
Yes, that's a huge issue.
I'll let you go on those three.
You want to start with the last one?
Yeah, start with that.
That one's interesting. Harry Cook, you know Harry. He's 10 years older than I am. Founder of King's Biology Department back in 1979. Great guy. Harry says, well, yeah, the lion and the lamb lay down together, but the lamb is pretty nervous.
I am so there.
Francis Schaeffer said something similar to that. He parses out, if you read Genesis, Space, and Time, he's struggling with this. He's a philosopher. He's not an ecologist. He's trying to figure this out, philosopher, theologian, slash guy. He's trying to figure it out. He said, well, there's death in the chase. And it's death in the chase that'll disappear, not death. Mm-hmm. And I've got to go back, and I've remembered that in the last week or so, and I thought, oh, I got to go back and parse it out and see what he was actually saying. And I'm not sure, you know, how far. So he's trying to parse out. Remember, he's the one who takes and divides things into the above the line and the below the line. These features we share with God, and these on the personal side, and on the machine side we share with the machine. That's how he was trying to. But what your students are asking is a profoundly important question. But I think we have made theodicy, the problem of pain, the Darwin with the stinging insect thing, we've let that take over. And many theologians now are saying, what about suffering? What is the role of suffering? And George Murphy talks about this. He gets at this. That's one whole piece of it that's really we need to explore and bring forward. There's a history in the church on suffering. And we need to think about that. The other piece that Murphy does, which I think is brilliant, he has showed us the hiddenness of God. And you see it in Job, you see it elsewhere, you see it in Jesus' life. And Pilate says, are you the king of the Jews? Tell me.
Okay, so
he won't speak to it.
Okay.
He doesn't reveal himself. He comes as a servant. He comes as a lamb, or the metaphors. There's mystery going on here, but God is hidden. Don McKay talks about this stuff. You can explain the entire thing, every bit of detail. You haven't got it.
So I should just say it's a mystery. Because well, I'm good with that. But
No. That's too easy. And what I'm trying to do is avoid what we've been doing all of my life in evangelicalism. We've been given the bad answers. Yeah. It's like the Star Wars movie, if you saw that one, the newer ones, where the young Kirk is being induced into the academy and he breaks the rules and he can't go to space. And so Bones goes and he gives him the flu. And he's running around and says, oh my goodness, the tongue. And his tongue, he can't talk. And suddenly he can't talk. And Bones says, I can fix that. Bang. And he sticks him with something. And he goes, ow! And his tongue's okay. And then his hands swell up. And he goes, oh, my hands. He says, oh, I can fix that. Boom. And that's what we've been doing in the church. You got a problem with God? I can fix that. You got a problem with God? I can fix that. And Job said, I got a problem with God. And his friend said, I can fix that. And for 38 chapters, they tried to fix it. This is a problem we cannot solve. And somehow, in our preaching, and then it will flood into our teaching. I know, you and I were raised in the academy. I'm a product of the Enlightenment too. There isn't a thing that I can't answer. We can eventually get an answer to it. We have flown. We've gone to space. We've gone to the moon. We're looking at exoplanets now. Don't tell me there's nothing I can't do. I will extend life. I will break down every barrier. We've been, and your students believe that too. We believe in technological improvement forever going on, practically. And what I'm saying to you, you hit death. Wow.
I agree with that. I guess I'm just going to push a little bit farther.
Okay.
Just ask, what do you say to people that say, well, are you okay with guinea worms then? When you go from the big picture to the particular.
No.
So how do you talk about that?
But the same Jesus is doing all the things he's doing about the cross and the garden and all the rest of that is the same one as telling the story of the Good Samaritan.
Right.
He's the same one as talking about the Pharisees and the tax collectors. He's the same one that's healing a handful of people. Jesus, you healed him, but look at all those other people. You hung out up in northern Galilee, like in the backwoods, up country. What are you doing? Get down to Jerusalem where you can really, in fact, get over to Rome where you can really help people. This is old preaching. See, our students, I think sometimes they haven't had good preaching. I've had preachers that came out of the mission field. They came out of Ecuador when Jim Elliott and Nate Saint were killed. That's where. And then Richard Carlson. I went to North Park in Carlson Tower 4 years after David Carlson lost his life. He was a medical doctor. He was brilliant. He was full of passion. And the rebels shot him dead. Accidentally. He got caught in the crossfire. See, I don't think it's like my grandson has postnatal hydrocephaly. He's had 6 revisions from 6 weeks to 2 years of age. He had a bleed on the 3rd revision. I talked with his brain surgeon. Okay? The guy that my daughter was really ticked at. Now, he saved his life, but he gave him partial paralysis on his side, and he's got brain seizures now. We moderate with medicine. I thank God for the medicine. I thank God for that doctor. But, oh, I wish he had just moved his hand slightly the other way, because Ryland's just such a good kid. And I can't explain. Well, I can do everything I can to train the next generation of doctors to be as good as they can be and better than the one that has done such wonderful. Because hydrocephaly, Kathy and I met in a school for handicapped, we call them retarded kids in those days, in Washington State, and we had hydrocephaly kids. Their bodies were about that long. Their head was about that big. Mm-hmm. They were 20-some years old. They were in diapers and laying, and they were turning them from time to time. And by 30 or 35, those people were dead. So I knew where my grandson was going. But in my lifetime, he's in first grade. Woohoo! And that's the blessing of God on us. So the technology is wonderfully blessing us. But then we take it and we double down and triple down. And we say, no, that wasn't God. That's us. And this is fundamental. That we have to retell. I think the Tower of Babel story has to be retold. It's more, probably more important than Genesis 3 and the garden story. And we don't even talk about the Tower of Babel. But do we have, we don't need Esperanza or some common language, because now you can do what? Type it into Google and hit translate. Artificial intelligence programs are making that what? That's getting better and better and better and better and better. Because you and I have all lived long enough to know what it was in the 90s when you tried to get a translation. And now, today, it just does it for you.
Okay, we have time for one more question. Charles.
Yeah.
John, thank you so much for calling our attention to a change in perspective of death.
Okay.
I'd like to quote from 1 Corinthians 15.
Yes.
15:54, death has been swallowed up in victory.
Yes.
Paraphrasing Isaiah 5:8.
Yes.
Where, O death, is your victory? Where, yes. O death, is your sting?
Yes.
Flip death around. Death is not an end.
Is
not an end.
Yeah.
Death is a new beginning.
Yeah. Yeah.
It has no sting anymore.
It has no sting.
It means nothing.
No. Yeah, my theologian friends tell me, we live in this between time, right? It's then, but not yet. I mean, it's we are saved, but we're still here. We're in these bodies. They will be transformed. Jesus' body and the things he does expresses exactly that.
And it's always been there in plain sight.
Yes, plain sight. Deuteronomy 30 has been there in plain sight too. Moses stands today, and he says, he stands between the two mountains. Moses never made it into the promised land, but he says in the text that he's standing between Mount Ebal, but visually, he's standing between Mount Ebal and Mount Gerizim. And on Ebal, he says, on this hand, I give you curses, death, and dying. On this hand, I give you life and blessing. Now choose life, that you and your children may live. Okay? I urge you. I urge us as a society to choose life. It stands before us. Thanks. It's been good to be with you.
Thank you, John.